I kind of see myself as, and I see our supporters as giving through charity. So I'm just giving through them because this is something I feel I want to stand up and say I care about this. And they're kind of helping me do that.
You're listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar podcast, talking all things fundraising, charities, nonprofits, and more. Here's your host, as always, Simon Scriver.
As you can imagine, I'm on a lot of charity newsletter mailing lists, so I get a lot of emails, I get a lot of stuff from the post, and a lot of it just kind of comes and goes, and I look at it from a purely analytical, interested observer kind of point of view. But there's one gentleman, well, there's a few gentlemen, but one gentleman who's with me today is a man whose newsletters seem to keep my interest. And so I asked him on today so that we could possibly talk through what the secret to his success is, or at least what his philosophy is when it comes to writing to donors, writing to supporters and potential donors. And so I'm very delighted to welcome Robin Peake to the podcast. Hello, Robin.
Hi, Simon. How's it going?
That's good. That's a very manly voice compared to mine. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
I like it. Robin, who are you?
So I'm the senior fundraising exec at a charity called Home for Good, where I've been there for a year. It's a fostering and adoption charity. And before that, I was 6 years at a charity called Innovista.
And when you're in Innovista, that was when I kind of got to know you. I got to know you through Twitter online, really. And now we know each other. We're in real life buddies.
If I was getting married again, you'd be my best man.
So. Yeah, really? Oh, brilliant. Oh, I love that. And in your Innovista days, I joined your mailing list. I think it was like a mystery shopping act, or I think you'd kind of asked people just to get on it. And it really struck me as something, you know, you write a lot of your own stuff, don't you? Because you're basically generally a small charity kind of guy.
Yeah, I like small shops. I think you can play around a bit more. And I guess that was kind of my entry. So I came into Innovista as a lone fundraiser on kind of comms and fundraising. And I laugh when people talk about small charity, right? Because they'll say, oh, I'm in a small charity. There's only two people in our digital brand team. And I'm like, you really don't know what a small charity is like, do you? So we were small, like struggling to meet payroll, small, like, one month I, instead of getting paid, give the charity a loan, kind of small. But that was really fun days. And then we grew. But yeah, I mean, small shops, I think, are a really good place to learn. So I've kind of been a bit of a generalist. And that's kind of just helped me get experience across a real range of stuff. So yeah, it's fun.
I mean, I love working in small shops as well. But the interesting thing about it is sometimes from working with other fundraisers in small shops, you can see you get pulled away from stuff that aren't appeals or aren't asking for money. And things like thank you letters, things like newsletters with no ask in them, they sometimes seem to get neglected in a small shop because you've only got so much time. But you always strike me as someone who doesn't neglect those. And no matter what mailing list of yours I've been on, there's been like a steady stream of non-asking communication. That's obviously important to you.
Yeah, it's really important. And I think it's in line with my values, but it's also good business. So when I joined Innovista, we had some cash flow issues and there was a sense that the best way to raise more money was to raise new money. Mm-hmm. This was my first fundraising job and I kind of went along with that for a while. But then I just started asking questions of, you know, we got these existing supporters. Let's talk to them and try to reorientate us as a charity towards focusing on our visible supporters rather than focusing on invisible supporters. So there's kind of magic people who were out there just ready to throw money at us if only we could find them. And so I guess that came through and we didn't really do any printed stuff. We did a kind of annual review once a year. But most of our comms was kind of e-newsletter. And I don't really like the word newsletter because it's charity focused, right, rather than supporter focused. So it's what's going on in our world. I kind of came in to fundraising. It wasn't my shtick before that, so I wanted to learn. So I just kind of went to people who seemed like they were good at it and who'd written books on it and then kind of just followed their advice. And then as I kind of was in a bit longer, realized that not everyone was doing that. So it was quite easy to stand out in a way, by actually, you know, going to a conference and not just taking notes, but actually changing how you do things.
There's a few things I want to unpack there. You said, for a start, you said you don't like the word newsletter. What do you call them in your organizations when you're running the show?
We just call them emails, really, because but you know, I don't think it needs a brand. I mean, you know, I don't think you need to kind of give your e-newsletter a name. I don't think supporters really care about that stuff.
No, it's more of an internal name, isn't it? If anything, probably the word newsletter or a name for something makes it feel like it's going to 1,000 people or 10,000 people.
Yeah.
But your emails, from what I've seen, and I know that emails, when I try and write them for nonprofits, it's meant to feel like one person to another person.
Yeah.
And we don't put like a banner headline on emails when we write to friends.
Yeah. And that was the whole point, you know. So I guess there was a couple of things we tried to do. We only ever told one story, and it was definitely a story about a beneficiary, for want of a better word. In a sense, I saw my role as kind of presenting the story to the supporter who'd played a part in that story and letting them know that. So I guess I treated everyone on our mailing list as our supporters, whether they were giving or not, because they'd shown some sort of interest in us. And we kind of did a bit of segmentation, but we didn't actually do loads, because, I mean, this was a mailing list of, you know, under 1,000 people. So there's not, So it was really about giving people one story. We kind of presented the problem that the donor had helped to solve. And it was about connecting that supporter with the individual who they had helped. We did things like kind of run through, you know, how many yous are here and how many mentions of we or us or charity name, and just try to strip those all away. Because that's default, right, is that we kind of insert ourselves as the hero in the story rather than the supporter. And I just think people really got it, you know, and we didn't really do kind of links to click through on. If I wanted people to respond, I would just say, if you want to respond to this, hit reply. And that was just a way to kind of build connections with people, because it came from my email address. And the bits I loved was when people would reply without prompting, just to say they'd been encouraged, and that, you know, any unsolicited feedback that's positive or negative, I guess, is, you know, it's just a real chance to engage with people. It's helpful, isn't it, when you do it, when people kind of give you live feedback, it helps you realize that there are people who read it and get it.
Yeah, it can be surprising sometimes, because sometimes there's almost a frustration that you're blasting out into the void, especially if there's not a call to action in that. You know, if it's an appeal and you're asking for money, there's a very clear measurement of people are responding to it. But if you're just giving people an update or a thank you, that response is huge, because you haven't asked them to do it and they've just gone out their way to feedback to you. And that's lovely.
Yeah.
You're a big fan of thank yous and gratitude, which obviously kind of ties into the newsletter. But is your approach very different in a thank you? Is it still a story? Is it still one story out in a thanks?
I mean, my aim with a thank you is, so we don't do, so Home for Good where I am now, we don't do thank you letters or thank you emails. We do handwritten thank you cards, and our volume allows us to do that for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so my aim in writing someone a thank you is that it feels personal and that they feel known. So if they have volunteered with us, if they've given before, if they're a regular donor and this is a special gift, I want them to know that we know who they are, we recognize them, because I think that will give them value. I think it helps them feel like they're not just a number. Mm. And so, you know, in terms of the content of my thank you cards is, I mean, it's probably 100 words. I'm generally not including a story within that, because, you know, sometimes I'll include a little anecdote and try to, you know, I don't have a script that I follow, because I don't want to feel scripted in that. I want to feel like I can write to Simon, who is different from Mary, who I wrote a thank you card to 5 minutes ago. And I think that for me came from, so when I started out, I didn't have much of a personal development budget. So I went to TFAN, big international aid charity, to kind of learn from them how they were doing things. And the guy made a comment of, oh, we're trying to act like a smaller charity. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really interesting. I'm trying to act like a bigger charity.
Yeah.
I feel like I need to fit in. You know, I need to, you know, we need fancy letterhead and glossy magazine to kind of compete. And I realized that actually we could compete by being small and kind of use that to our advantage. And I think that was a big turning point for me, because we started, so in Avista, we just ditched our thank you letters because we weren't getting so many donations that we kind of had a template anyway. I think it was just much more personal. It gave us opportunities to really connect with people, started using the phone a lot more, reorientated. So both at Innovis and Home for Good, I've reorientated who finds out first when someone makes a donation online.
Okay.
Because in both charities, it was kind of going to the finance and then the finance would process it and then let me know.
Oh God.
And now, yeah, so you end up banking the gift before you thank the gift.
Yeah.
Which is just that just doesn't fit with how I see the world at all. And so now I get if someone makes an online donation, I straight away get an email notification. So like yesterday morning, someone set up a regular gift. It's actually one of our staff. So I was able to, like, within 3 minutes of her setting up a regular gift, I could just send her a text that was like, "You legend."
Yeah.
She's like, "Oh, you're quick off the mark." But just being able to kind of, I think in that moment, as soon as someone has donated, there's that kind of just that high that they've done something good.
Yeah.
And I want straight away to be able to reinforce that for them. So I loved kind of calling people up, like literally, you know, just as they were kind of closing down their internet window, to just be like, "You've just done an amazing thing." And loved kind of doing that and trying to get thank you cards out quickly. So I don't have many metrics, but one of my metrics is that 80% of our thank yous go out within 48 hours. My record for a thank you card from office to door is 2 hours, which is for someone who lived in Oxford, where I live. So, I might beat that someday, but maybe not.
Yeah. Your dream is just as soon as they click the button, you're there at the window. Thank you.
There's that line between being personal and being creepy, isn't there? Like,
Let me ask you a little bit about volume, because you reminded me, I saw someone on Twitter recently talking about donor love, not complaining about it, but saying like this idea of donor love and this kind of gushing thank yous that we issue to our donors, that it's not possible as a charity gets big because the volume is just too much. And I've always felt like your resources grow as your donations grow.
Yeah.
And so it is possible. And you've said there about Tier Fund trying to act small. Is there like a reverse tipping point where an organization, you know, it's just unrealistic to send thank you cards, handwritten thank you cards to everyone?
I mean, your hand might get sore. Like my hand gets sore after like 5 or 6. You know,
yeah.
What I mean? And I think there is a question of how do we scale this up? But I guess, I mean, that's a question more about a mechanism rather than an approach. So can a charity of any size love their donors? Yes. And they need to work out kind of how that looks for them. So I had an ActionAid face-to-face fundraiser come around the door this couple of years back. Honestly, their welcome journey was just amazing. In terms of, they just wanted me to feel great about the decision I just made, and I really did. It was really standout, you know, and they're doing that on a big volume. It's not a handwritten thank you card, it's an email campaign. Mm-hmm. It was personal, and it just reinforced that I'd made a really good decision to give them 10 or a month or whatever it was. And so there is the kind of, how do you scale it? But I think it's about, you know, what we're looking at. It, you know, I think we generally see acquisition as a way of making money and retention as a way of kind of keeping money. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, retention as a strategy for income growth is a strategy. And so I generally have worked off 12-month income budgets as these are your targets. But actually, you know, I'd love to be at the point where your target is to grow retention by this much. Mm-hmm. You know, and the stats, you know, I think Tom Ahern has some stat that says if you can grow retention by 10%, in some cases we've seen income grow by 50%. Mm. Like, who doesn't want to see income grow by 50%? Do you know what I mean? Mm. But we tend to think that big income growth is coming from acquisition. And I think for smaller charities, I think it's, you know, it's just it's a lot more difficult to compete on acquisition. But for the folks who we have in, like, we can become their favorite charity so that when they review their given, you know, their monthly given at the end of the year, whatever, we're the last to drop off and the first to get increased. And I just think there's a real opportunity to kind of be a face and kind of be known. And I think staff retention is important in that. You know, so if you got charity turn at small charities, that makes that difficult because then, you know, the loan funders you were talking to 6 months ago isn't the same person now and mightn't be in a year's time. And yeah.
Yeah, I think like retention is probably the easiest win, you know, and I think we spend a lot of time talking about acquisition and especially smaller nonprofits who maybe haven't really thought about it, that there's an effort to try and make everyone in the world care about your organization. But actually sometimes all we need is that handful of people who already care, and we just need to, like you said, make them become their number one charity, become their default charity. I love the retention side of it. I love the thank you side of it, but I feel like it's neglected a lot of the time because it doesn't feel like you're spending money on raising money. Do you know what I mean? It
Well,
feels like,
it's seen as a cost, isn't it, rather than investment generally. So yeah, you know, and so you get people of, you know, well, stamps are more expensive than a franking machine. Well, yeah, they are. But, you know, you wouldn't say that about, you know, send out your appeal, or, you know, the appeal's going to be more expensive if we do it by post rather than email. That's not how you look at it. It's what's going to raise us more money. And maybe we need to get better in measuring that because it's a lot easier to measure acquisition stuff and appeals rather than necessarily measuring thanking. But I think, you know, we can do it. And you know, I was with a charity last week and I was encouraging them to just do some A/B testing on their new donors and kind of send half of them a handwritten thank you card. Do that over 3 months and just see what happens in a year's time of who's stuck with and who's increased. And yeah.
Yeah, and that's your measure. I mean, what kind of results have you seen from this? Is it worth it? Is it worth the time and the effort you put into this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we doubled income at Innovista over a period of about 5 years. I mean, I can't remember exactly, but you know, I don't think we increased our mailing list by more than 20%. You know, it was simply about kind of treating people well, and we started profiling our supporters as well. So in our, I mean, this is very unscientific, but in our annual reviews, we used to show stories of the impact in an individual, but we would trace that to an individual donor. So it would be Sue gives £25 a month, which, you know, has made the difference for this person, and then kind of tell their story. So it was just, you know, you might have a little author bio and a magazine piece. It was just like the donor bio. And when we profiled a supporter in that way, and we said, hey, can we just have your photo and kind of, you know, show your name? They, like all of them, increased their engagement over time. So, like the regular donor started giving more, the major donor started giving more. And it was just because they'd identified with us in a way. And it was a really simple request for them to oblige to say, yeah, we give. And, you know, but then I think to get that through the post, I know that other people have got that through the post and kind of associate you with the charity and that your money has made this difference. And I think, I mean, going back to your comment on, you know, is it scalable in big charity? I think there's a question of do you need to do it for everyone? And so I'm treasurer for our local church, which, like, I'm much better at raising money than counting money. So it's not a job I enjoy. But we moved our kind of accounts onto an accounting package called Xero. And like, it's just not my world and I don't really understand it. And so I booked a support call with them, which I was kind of, yeah, just trying to get some help. And then I forgot he was calling. My wife is out, so I was looking after our two kids who I think like were 3 and 6 months. And I was just manic. Like, I'm on the phone, I'm trying to like give one of them a screen, give one of them a bottle of milk, like trying to do a support call, which should have taken like 10 minutes, but ended up taking like half an hour. And the guy, you know, I guess he was asking questions about, you know, what was going on and the kids and stuff. But anyway, about a week later, I got this box like delivered to our house from Xero, from Phil, the customer service guy. And in the box was a baby grow for our little six-month-old daughter, a remote control car for my son, a little like Bible journal, because I guess he clocked he's the treasure of a church, I might like this, and some coloring in pencils for my kids. And like, I mean, I guess, you know, the box probably costs 20 quid in terms of the stuff that's in it.
Yeah.
And like, there's no way Xero we're going to do that for everyone. But it just had this little card that said, you know, something like, we loved helping you out, especially when you had your hands full.
Yeah.
And like, I'm just never going to leave them, you know, and they have like Xero have like a million subscribers, and like our little outfit gives them like 30 quid a month. So like in the whole, you know, can your charity be too big? Can your donor be too small to love them well? And like, you know, I tweeted about it. I'm talking about it now, you know, in terms of like, I encourage finance people to switch over to Xero, even though I don't understand that world at all.
Yeah.
And I guess it's that you don't need to do it for everyone, but if you can do it for some people and kind of do it, you know, reactively, and that's about culture, right? That's not about strategy and process. That's just about a guy on a customer service hotline feeling free to do something nice because there's that culture that encourages that and allows for that. And there's, you know, they could have done it better, right? The baby grow had Xero branding on it. Like, there's a difference between a gift and advertising. Like, I'm not going to dress.
The Bible had, there was a Bible with a few mentions of Xero finance they had that.
Yeah. But so there's a difference, you know, because I think sometimes we think, right, oh, I want to give someone a gift. Here's a gift with our logo on it. Like, that's not a gift. That's marketing.
Here's a stress ball with our logo on it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's weird. I mean, because you talked about values right at the beginning of the podcast, and you're talking about culture there. And I always wonder with these companies who are doing it well, how much of it is the company and the strategy and the policy, and how much of it is the individual who just actually gives a shit and gets it? And I think the answer is maybe somewhere in between. The one I think of sometimes is the coffee shop in the UK, possibly Costa, and every member of staff is allowed to give away one cup of coffee for free.
It's Prez, definitely not Costa. Prez. Prez.
And I think that's a really it's a really interesting one because it's like it's obviously dreamt up by some marketing person at the top who sees this as a way of winning customers over, of getting mentioned on social media, and then they drill it down, and then there's a more personal level where the guys on the bottom think, okay, this is awesome, I have this power and I can use this every day. But how do you know how do organizations bring that in if you don't have a free cup of coffee? Like, how do you teach someone like this guy from Xero account package, how do you teach someone like that to be nice? How do you teach someone like that to like make people feel special? Can you build policy around that?
Yeah, I think it's hard to kind of to build processes around creating culture and to kind of mandate culture. So I think you know, if you're a fundraising leader, I think you got to model it. Mm-hmm. And I think when you see it in others, you got to shout so loud about it so that other people know. So when I was at Innovista, we worked internationally training leaders, and we did a Christmas card campaign where one of my colleagues in the Ukraine hand-wrote 200 Christmas cards to send to supporters. Mm-hmm. And she took them down to the post office. So they were kind of being posted internationally, which was oddly cheaper than sending it from the UK. She dropped one and like dropped it down a drain or something. So she went back to the office to like look up the spreadsheet with the 200 names and like tally up the 199 cards to find out who she dropped. And like that couple who got that card don't know what effort she went to make sure they got it, right?
Yeah.
I made sure everyone in our team knew because she had done something like way above and beyond to value supporters. And I just really wanted to shout about it. And so now, you know, I'm in an organization that works primarily, we work remotely. So we use Slack, which is kind of internal messaging, and that works really well for us. But if I see someone do something really well, I want to let other people in the team know about it. So we did a thankathon, which was mostly just handwritten cards. But then when we got a gift for like back after one of those thank you cards, or when we got someone thanked one of the team for sending her a thank you card. So I wanted to make sure the whole team knew that, because that's the culture we want to model and create. And I think, I mean, I've been in charities where, you know, frontline staff aren't, they don't really want to get involved in fundraising.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of that thing that happens over there. But if you repivot fundraising to be, you know, fundraising is not just about asking for money. Like, you absolutely can't ignore that, you know, and you can't, like, don't get me wrong, I'm not just thanking people and never asking for money. Don't hear that from me. But if we reorientate the organization to say, you know, it's not just about asking for, you know, can you help with fundraising? And it involves calling up some supporters and saying thank you. I mean, people are like, well, yeah.
You
know, because it's a much easier sell. They don't need to feel awkward about asking or what, you know, whatever their hangups are. And that, I think, just helps fundraising to kind of become integrated and seen as, you know, not just those weird people over there.
What do you do about people who, how do I put this, who aren't nice? So, I mean, you naturally have positive values. You're a nice guy. I like you. But then, you know, you've got people who, you know, I'm not going to say they always work in the finance department, but some people who are just not into people. I was running a workshop the other day, and we were talking about corporate fundraising, and I was saying, you know, a part of engaging people is asking them questions and finding out what they're interested in and being, like, genuinely interested. And this woman asked the question. She was like, what do we do if we genuinely don't give a shit? And I loved her for her honesty. Yeah. But it was kind of like, I was a little bit stumped. I was like, you know, part of me wants to say, well, you're in the wrong business. Yeah. But the other part of me is kind of like, well, you have to find that interest. You know, what is it possible to, like, do you know, does it feel faked when these companies and these nonprofits are trying to be interested in you and sending you out stuff? Can you smell it when it's fake, and how do you work around that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, I mean, I agree, I love her honesty on that, and yeah, I mean, she'll probably not still be there in 2 years, right? But I think I mean, so for me, there's a value driven case for this, right? In terms of and at Home for Good, I came in and one of our values is to be relational. So I've been just able to hold a mirror up to the organization. That's Mira for anyone who's not Irish. But hold a mirror up to the organization and say, actually, you know, are we being relational here? And if we say this is our values, then, you know, we've got to live out our values, right? Yeah. So there's a values-driven case, but there's also just a business case for this stuff, right? So, you know, you convince your finance people by saying, if we, you know, if instead of just sending out gift receipts by email, I mean, I got one from a charity recently that basically, it just told me everything I knew about myself. So it's like, thank you for your donation of £15. Your title, Mister. Your first name, Robin. Your second name. I'm like, I know that. Like, I'm me.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to tell me that. What are you doing? But, you know, so I'm not, you know, I don't, that's a transaction, right? You know, that's like, I've just bought something on Amazon. So I'm not tripping over myself to come back and donate again. But when I just think when we're nice to people, they're nice back. You know, and in fundraising, that results in people giving more money for longer.
What you obviously are on a lot of mailing lists as well, and you make a lot of donations. What's the kind of stuff you get that you hate?
Well, I hate anything that has kind of newsletter in the title, you know, and so it's kind of like, you know, this month's edition, and it's just like, yeah, I'm just not interested in the stuff that you're interested in as a charity. You're not communicating to me in that way.
Like the feeling that you're sitting at home waiting for.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's the first of the month. Oh, I can't, you know, I'm just waiting for it to land.
Yeah, you guys are a day late. Is everything okay in there?
Yeah. You know, I've just been rereading your old newsletter in the meantime. And I think anything that's just internally focused and focused on stuff I'm not interested in. And I guess, like, I give to charities I care about, right? So I don't generally give to, I mean, I do a little bit of mystery shopping, but I generally give to charities that I care about. So when they communicate with me with stuff that I don't care about, it's just a bit off-putting. And, you know, it's about processes or internal stuff, or it's just, and also, you know, I kind of see myself as, and I see our supporters as giving through charity. So the charity is the means to the end, right? So I get every Christmas I give to a charity up in Manchester called the Boaz Trust, who work with asylum seekers, because I kind of feel like that's something I should be doing, but I just don't feel I've got capacity for it. Like, I just feel, you know, and the climate around refugees and asylum seekers in the UK, like, it's just something that I feel I want to show I care about, but I don't have, well, I'm not making capacity to kind of volunteer or anything like that. So every Christmas, like, and oddly, I do literally wait for their appeal, like, because it's like, and I don't care what they say. Like, I don't read it. I just respond to it.
It's just the trigger for you. You know it's coming, but you're waiting for that trigger.
Yeah, there's something about Christmas, and it's just kind of, it's become a little tradition for me. But for me, I'm not, you know, they're just the only asylum seeker refugee charity I know, although actually there's another one in Oxford. But anyway, so I'm just giving through them because this is something I feel I want to stand up and say I care about this, and they're kind of helping me do that.
Yeah. Do they only send you the Christmas appeal, or do they send you stuff in between? What would happen if you got an appeal in the summer from them? Would you give?
I don't know.
I like to imagine sometimes what these databases say about us, like what the people inside, where we fall in the category, if you're a major donor, if you're, you know, because every organization is measuring these things a little bit differently. You wonder what, like, funnel you're in or what journey you're on in there, and what they've decided about you.
Yeah, kind of personality. So, well, I could give them my Myers-Briggs and stuff like that, you know.
You said when we were chatting before we were recording, you were saying you hate this idea of supporter journey or donor journey. Not hate it, but you don't like the phrasing of it. Why is that?
I don't know. I think it's a buzzword, isn't it? And we're all about buzzwords in our sector. And I think a lot of people can use a buzzword, and so you think they get it, they internalize it. And I've even met people who've got like supported journey in their job title, and they just don't care about people. And it's like, what are you doing? And so I was talking to someone from a big charity recently, and she was like, yeah, so I'm on kind of regular giving. And she was like, you know, until recently, I just didn't think of people after their second gift, you know? And so they're in, they've kind of given their second gift, right, great, bank them, move on. And it's just, so you end up a classic leaky bucket. And so, yeah, I mean, I think what I do enjoy is, I think this stuff is getting a bit more profile recently. So there's now an IOF supporter experience, special interest group. It's become an award at the National Fundraising Award, so it's being noticed. But I mean, I was at I Wish I Thought of That in February this year, and I've been there a few times, and I love it. Loads of great ideas, but like 95% of the ideas are all around acquisition. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not saying, oh, I wish I thought of that great idea to keep our supporters engaged and loyal. It's, oh, I've got this great idea to find new supporters that quite frankly, sometimes we need to find because we're not keeping our existing supporters engaged and loyal.
Yeah. I mean, there's a part of me that believe in acquisition, obviously, and I think it's key. But sometimes I feel like acquisition takes care of itself to a certain extent. I could get slammed for saying that. But it takes care of itself to a certain extent if your retention is great. You know, as your organization and your income grows and your circles naturally grow, that just happens as your organization lives and as it breathes and as it builds. But you have to take care of your retention first. Like, that's the difference between a great fundraising department and a not great fundraising department. It isn't in acquisition, it's in retention. But I don't know how naive that is of me to think that.
I don't know. I mean, I just can't think that this doesn't happen in the business world. Like, even my mechanic, right? My mechanic every year sends me like a letter to remind me that my service is due. You know, and they, you know, the more I keep going, the more kind of easy he is to pay. Do you know what I mean? Like the kind of easier he is to negotiate with, because he recognizes that I'm there twice a year. And it would just be stupid for him to bring people in for a service or an MOT and overcharge them and treat them really badly and hope that new people are going to replace them. It's just bad business, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. So did I tell you before, I wish I thought of that I want to present is on thank you letters. Like I want to,
yes.
I wish I invented the thank you letter. And one day, I don't know if it's too vague. So you seem to be sharing more about this and maybe as you've got more of a back catalog of great supporter experiences, you're presenting at IOF this year?
Yeah. I'm talking about the advantage of being small, which is kind of around kind of what small charities can do differently and what big charities can learn from us. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
And that's going to be, you're going to be sharing all about the way you interact with your donors, your supporters?
Yeah, I have no idea yet.
You're supposed to pretend that it's all sorted.
Okay, yeah. We'll see.
That's cool. So if anyone else wants to find out more, I suppose, about you and actually kind of keep an eye on your own supporter journey, what's the best place to find you, Robin?
Yeah, so I live in Oxford, so come, let's hang out, because I enjoy that.
You walking on your stepping desk.
Yeah, I got a stepper to go on my stand-up desk. Simon's just watching me bob up and down.
Yeah.
Very nauseating.
Mesmerizing.
I'm on Twitter, which is at Robin_Peak.
Mm-hmm. Who's Robin Peak without an underscore?
I don't know. Maybe I like the underscore, Simon.
Yeah. Oh, really? It's a part of your values.
It's who I am. Yeah. You take the underscore away, I'm no one.
So Twitter's your big place.
Yeah. And I mean, Twitter's been great. Like, I mean, I wouldn't know you through Twitter, but even aside from that, it's been a really good place to kind of meet people and connect with people. And I've just found fundraisers to be just so generous. And I mean, conferences are helpful, but I find them helpful for the breaks and the after time. And just kind of finding people to say, hey, can we hang out and pick your brains? And people are really happy to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you've mentioned it a few times, even in this podcast, of people you've met and sat down with and looked at their stuff. People are very generous at sharing what they've gone through and their own mistakes and successes, aren't they? That's where you learn fundraising, really. Nice. So you're open to people contacting you for advice?
My expectations are pretty low, but I'm open.
All right, cool. Okay, Robin, listen, thanks a million for taking time, not from stepping, but from taking time from your busy day. And that was really insightful. I'm looking forward to seeing you speak in July at IOF.
Are you going to come?
Yeah, as long as my session doesn't clash with
yours. You're going to bring a banner?
Definitely come to yours. No, I'll hide down the back and kind of make...
I might make you a t-shirt.
Ooh, Robin_Peak. I'll take
awesome.
It.
Awesome.
I'm looking forward to that. And thanks so much again, Robin. We'll have you back soon.
So, thanks,
Simon. Take care. Thank you.
Bye.
You've been listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and head over to changefundraising.com to learn more or get in touch with Simon. Or don't. Whatever. You're big enough to make your own decisions.
Hello. This is Morgan Freeman. For discounts on Simon's best-selling online fundraising courses, go to www.changefundraising.com/training and use coupon code podcast. Complete them in your own time, wherever you want. Get busy living or get busy buying.